Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be breaking down the election and looking at how reproductive rights played a role in how it all went down. Also, Jennifer Nelson will be on to talk about the complex relationship between women's magazines and their audiences. Seems like conservatives are beginning to realize that their hardline opposition to reproductive rights is politically toxic. The strategy isn't, sadly, to give up on fighting women's rights, however, but simply to deny that's what's going on. Lou Dobbs on Fox News, for instance, tried to pretend repealing Roe v. Wade wouldn't hurt abortion rights.
Even if Roe v. Wade were turned back, and this governor has no intention of doing so, but even if it were done, the abortion rights would remain. It would be a matter for states.
It's an absurdity. It'd be tough for the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade.
If repealing Roe v. Wade wouldn't hurt abortion rights, then how come the people who oppose abortion rights have made that the central concern for decades? It's been less than a week since the 2012 elections came to a close, but I'm already feeling nostalgic.
Memories like the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor memories.
Big story is that the nation got a full eyeball of how anti-choice militants, who are increasingly controlling the Republican Party, actually think. There is this ongoing belief a lot of liberals have that anti-choicers who oppose rape exceptions are somehow more admirable than those who don't, because it's somehow more consistent with the claim that opposition to abortion is about life. What we discovered is actually they're just really dedicated misogynists who don't really think of rape as that big a deal. Todd Akin's comments were the most obvious example of this.
Well, you know, people always want to try and make that as one of those things. Well, how do you slice this particularly tough sort of ethical question? It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
This got a lot of attention for being scientifically inaccurate, but what's more interesting to me is how this really shows why anti-choicers are becoming more aggressively opposed to rape exceptions. It has nothing to do with life and everything to do with what Akin was on about here, which is their belief that most rape victims weren't really raped. Back in the 70s, anti-choicers were okay with rape exceptions because most rape was de facto legal, so it's not like women really could get them anyway. They assumed it would only affect virgins attacked by strangers in alleyways. Akin's meaning was quite clear. He's one of those who thinks you were asking for it if you were drinking or went out on an unchaperoned date. Merely going to a party makes you wicked enough to deserve forced childbirth. The only reason this aspect is getting less play than it should is that a lot of people still think that a woman brought rape on herself in certain circumstances. Because of all this, Akin lost to McCaskill by over 15 points. Richard Murdoch of Indiana also lost a Senate race he was expected to win by making a stupid comment about rape. Murdoch, when confronted with the same question, knew better than to openly suggest that rape victims are lying sluts who had it coming. But he didn't really do much better.
I know there are some who disagree, and I respect their point of view, but I believe that life begins at conception. The only exception I have to have an abortion is in that case of the life of the mother. I struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize life is that gift from God, and I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
He put a slightly nicer spin on it, but the basic message was the same. First of all, the rapist is basically cast in this situation as if he's a force of nature, and rape is a thing that just happens to women. Again, forced childbirth is cast as something that's supposed to happen. There's an anti-choice narrative about how forced childbirth is a miraculous thing that turns bad girls into chaste mothers, and you can see it on play here. The whole fantasy is of a naughty girl who goes to parties getting raped, and now God has forced her to stay home with a baby as penance for her sinful ways. The rapist ends up being a tool of God's to control women. Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan also lost his bid when Obama-Biden won on Tuesday. Ryan was able to somewhat successfully minimize how he has long shared Aiken's views on rape, which is why he co-sponsored a bill in the House that would redefine rape narrowly, so that you basically had to be beat up for it to count. But he did slip up once during the campaign, talking about rape in such a way that it's clear he doesn't really think of it as a crime so much as just another way to maximize the number of women who are pregnant who don't want to be.
The method of conception doesn't change the definition of life.
You call it a horrible crime and a violation of a woman's bodily autonomy. He calls it a method of conception and an excuse to find more ways to take a woman's right to control her body. In a lot of ways, this quote from Ryan really summarizes how much anti-choicers revealed this election that they don't care about women and can't even be bothered to think about something like rape beyond seeing it as another opportunity to strip women of their right to decide when to give birth. Of course, the most depressing thing in all this is that for all the talk about abortion and rape, almost no one talked about how the rape exceptions don't even work, and how places where abortion is banned except for rape, most rape victims end up having to get black market abortions anyway. I'd like to welcome Jennifer Nelson to the program. Jennifer has been writing for women's magazines for nearly 15 years. She's written hundreds of articles on health, wellness, relationships, pop culture, pets, and travel for practically every chick slick on the stands, her words. She's decided to take that experience and apply it to a more analytic look at women's relationships to these glossies in her book titled Airbrushed Nation, The Lure and Loathing of Women's Magazines. Welcome to RealityCast, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Amanda.
So women's power in the quote-unquote real world grows all the time. The publishing industry in general is seeing a decline in sales numbers as the internet eats up their business. I mean, Newsweek just basically shut its doors. But women's glossies are selling better than ever. Why is this?
You know, I really wish I had the answer to that. I find that amazing as well. Or when I looked at a lot of numbers and when I tracked the statistics month to month while I was writing the book, I found that as well. Cosmo, especially, one of the most controversial women's magazines out there, because if you don't buy into the please your man and, you know, way that they treat the women reader sometimes, you know, it often has a lot of haters as well as a lot of subscribers. And yet Cosmo sales were going through the roof. Mary Claire and Glamour's were up there as well. And so some of them that are having difficulty and have had difficulty since the recession began in, you know, 2008-09, we started seeing a lot of them go down. A lot of them are glowing in the women's glossies. I think it just, some of the things resonate with readers still. The self-help mantra that the service article provides, that we're going to help you do things better. We're going to help you decorate better and have better style and get a better hairdo, and those kind of things still resonate with women, apparently.
What's interesting to me is, like, it seems to me like 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ago, that most of these sort of women's magazines were sort of aimed at the like 15 to 25 year old set. Right now, there's like a lot more women, it seems, buying them. Has that been your experience?
Oh, yeah. I think that age demographic has just increased and increased as well. Some of them now, I think Glamour just recently had a reshuffle, a new editorial design. And their demographic is suddenly like from 18 to 49. I mean, that's a huge, you know, span now. They're trying to please the 18-year-old as well as the, you know, 50-year-old midlife woman, you know. So I found that really interesting as well. I think many of them have such large spans now that we're trying to just nab everyone we can, from the young college woman who's just maybe graduated and starting out in her career to women with families and homes and careers trying to juggle it all still at, you know, 45 or 50. It's interesting how they've tried to do that, in other words.
So currently I have an InStyle magazine, but I have piled The Nation and New York magazine on top of it, so no one coming over can see. Why... Why do women feel guilty about reading these magazines?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. I talk a little bit about that in my book, and I say, we, you know, it's like reality TV. I love some of the Housewives and, you know, Project Runway or Survivor or whatever. And yet it's sort of this guilty pleasure, like, oh, don't really tell my coworkers that I watch, you know, Housewives, the Real Housewives of New York or whatever. And so it's kind of the same. Women's magazines are generally, for better or for worse, classified as cheesy and a vapid read and a guilty pleasure and fluff. And so, you know, it's kind of all where you're getting your fashion tips and you're looking at, you know, nail polish colors. And so even though they do run hard-hitting stories and inspiring stories and health information, that's cutting edge a lot of times, and there's lots of good things about them as well, there's that angle that, you know, you better cover that up with your Time or Newsweek, because someone you know might think you're, you know, looking at nail polish colors or how to change your hairstyle.
It's interesting to me because it's like, I think women are often sort of expected, even if we're to be taken as serious people, to still like look pulled together and look fashionable. And the expectation that we don't read magazines that tell us how to do this is kind of like onerous, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I agree totally. And I think sometimes we have to own that. Younger women are great about that. Women, my daughters now, I have a daughter in her 20s, and women her age now just own it. They're girls, and we're chicks, and we read chick flicks, and they're going to own that they can go out into the world and start their career and, you know, begin their lives on a positive, empowered note, and yet they want to look at the hairstyles and the latest fashions and what boots that they can, you know, snag if they can afford them, that kind of thing. So I think the younger generation is maybe doing it a little bit better without the embarrassment of the previous generation that thought that just reading that was kind of dumbing you down by default.
So it's interesting because I think, you know, like you said, these magazines often have like a lot more going on than just, you know, fashion and makeup and relationship stuff. Can you kind of talk about like some of the other reporting that they do?
Yeah, actually, in my book, I cover everything from politics to the celebrity interview to inspirational stories and stuff. And they do, and even politics. You know, a lot of the comments I got from readers was, well, women's magazines are writing about politics, but I'm just doing a blog about that today on my blog, and they are about, you know, I have a half a dozen women's magazines sitting here on my table, and five or six of them have covered, you know, of political in the last month or two. And so, you know, they really are reporting healthcare stuff is cutting edge, and news about things is coming more and more. And of course, it's still interspersed with all the traditional fluff that we think of when we think of women's magazines. But, you know, some of those stories are coming in, and things like, you know, the reproductive health is huge. Magazines like Marie Claire and Glamour and Self, every month they're running things, whether it's abortion or Planned Parenthood or hot button issues, emergency contraception. All of these things are debated and reported on a lot more often in the last couple of years, actually. And so that's good in a way. Now we could, you know, criticize them that they lean left, which is the case for the most part. And but they're trying to get better, and they're trying to give equal coverage, even though it may not always seem so equal. But some of those things that they're doing, you know, can be lauded as good stuff going on in there as well.
Let's talk about the reproductive health stuff a little bit more, because I am genuinely, I remember when I was young and the first time I'd like read a like glossy magazine, I was surprised at how they would often be skittish about most political issues, but on like abortion rights and contraception and things like that, they would often just be full-throated defenders of these things. And that seems to still be the case. You know, I know so many feminist like reproductive health advocates that place articles in places like Glamour and Marie Claire. Can you talk about the intensity of that in these women's magazines?
Yeah, there is, you know, when I looked at that issue that they consider political issues, abortion and birth control, although birth control has come into somewhat of a controversial issue during this latest campaign, emergency contraception, health insurance in general, Planned Parenthood, those kind of things, And yes, it definitely means that they're pro, you know, pro advocating them, that they try every now and then you'll see, you know, a kind of across the boards, maybe a debate between two governors who have different views or two, you know, people who are, legislating and, you know, that kind of thing. Why we, when we, you know, talk about the issues, but it's usually very pro, pro abortion and pro, birth control choice and very, negative toward the other side. There was an issue, there was an article in Glamour magazine just a few months ago where Maggie Gyllenhaal, the actress, talked about, Planned Parenthood and was all gung-ho for it. And she, you know, talked about the statistics about, you know, the controversy going on with Planned Parenthood and that kind of thing. And she talks about how her mother took her to a Planned Parenthood rally when she was in the sixth grade. And so she's always been an advocate and that kind of thing. So they use celebrities in a way to promote the cause in that way. And they do, you do see it, much more, you know, left leaning and still so. Even ones that try to be, more balanced, the left-leaning is still visible, in my opinion.
Hey, we don't have a problem with that here.
Yeah, Reality Cast.
You know, outside of like the direct political stuff, I read a really moving story on the Hairpin the other day by a woman who grew up in a fanatical religious cult. And quite literally, her first inkling of the world outside having more to offer women than just being a dutiful wife in a loveless marriage was a glossy women's magazine that somebody gave her in an airport. Do you think that that story sort of touches on something that's deeper about these magazines, sort of culturally? And I mean, what kind of role do they sort of play in the way that women sort of see themselves and how it's sort of changed from the past?
Yeah, that's a real interesting question. If you look back at the magazines over the years, my mother's generations of the Woman's Day and the Good Housekeeping and Ladies' Home Journal, it was very cultured to the homemaker. You know, the ads were everything from vacuum cleaners to, you know, your irons to everything in between that any good homemaker would want and need. And so those ideals have kind of shifted. We now have like a Red Book who focuses clearly on the working mom. They know that this woman is, you know, married, juggling a couple of kids, working full time. And so the articles are really geared to a more progressive woman more than generations ago, I think. So in that way, I think we've come a long way. Of course, then the negative of that is that you still have, you know, sex articles, and especially Cosmo is one of the worst, where every mantra that you take away is how to please your man, and where is the information for the woman to be empowered and, you know, get hers kind of thing. So, you know, for a little bit of good, have we progressed? Yes. And yet we still, in some certain areas, see, you know, a throwback to a couple of generations ago in some of the articles even today.
My guest today has been Jennifer Nelson. Her book is called Airbrushed Nation, The Lure and Loathing of Women's Magazines, and it's out on Seal Press, and it's available both in paperback and on Kindle form. Thanks for coming to RealityCast, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda. It was great.
One of the strangest narratives to emerge during this election from conservatives was this notion that a woman who cares about her reproductive rights cannot also care about other issues such as jobs or the economy. Over and over again, you heard conservative pundits claim that every time Obama highlighted reproductive rights, he was somehow saying that women don't care about anything else but sex, even though he often highlighted reproductive rights while also talking about other things he's done for women, such as signing the Lilly Ledbetter Act that protects women from pay discrimination. They promoted this narrative while claiming to be concerned about women, but in reality, what came across was this belief that if you want to control your uterus, you must somehow not be able to use your brain. Michelle Malkin reduced the whole narrative to a quip.
Vote with your lady smarts, not your lady parts.
Of course, the underlying assumption is that what's good for your reproductive health somehow must be bad for the rest of your life. But that's about the dumbest idea that I've ever heard. It's like saying, if your feet are warm, the rest of you must be cold. I'm sure this weird idea makes sense to conservatives who do tend to treat female sexuality like it's some great evil that needs to be controlled instead of a normal part of everyday life. But what was weird was how certain conservatives tried to sound when claiming that what is good for your reproductive health care must be bad for you economically. George Will sounded very certain that you can't both want insurance coverage for contraception and want lower unemployment at the same time.
Condescension of the Obama campaign, which says, Austin, hang on, which says essentially, don't you trouble your pretty little heads about these men's issues like unemployment and all the rest. Worry about contraception, which has been a constitutional right for 47 years.
For all his concerns that Obama condescended to women, the reality is that Will was the one being condescending. He claimed on TV that by caring about contraception, women must be too occupied to care about jobs. In reality, women are actually not stupid creatures who can only have one concern at a time. Women saw that Obama both passed an economic stimulus package that lowered the unemployment rate and that he passed a health care bill that provides for copay-free contraception. Women are also capable of wearing a pair of pants while also not wearing a shirt, though I suspect that George Will believes we put a shirt on and then get too distracted doing that to remember our pants. While George Will was putting a high-minded spin on the claim that supporting reproductive rights means that a woman literally can't think of anything else, Limbaugh was being totally crass about it.
Exactly. Women are people. They're not even being treated as people by the Obama campaign. You understand? You're being treated as you're being objectified. You're thought of as being dumb and stupid, and your emotions can be played upon here.
To be clear, he's literally saying that if a woman cares about her reproductive rights, she must be subhuman, stupid, and emotional. Thus, any candidate who supports reproductive rights is saying this. But in reality, the only people who were saying that women who care about reproductive rights are stupid were conservatives. Not only did Limbaugh equate caring about reproductive rights with being stupid and being objectified, he called women who take the issue seriously sex machines.
It again looks at women as monolithic sex machines who want to make sure they've got unending birth control pills and then free trip to Planned Parenthood the next day, all paid for by Obama.
Here are the facts, courtesy of the Guttmacher Institute. 99% of Americans have sex by the age of 44. 95% of Americans have sex without being married first. More than 99% of women who have had sexual intercourse have used contraception. Among women at risk for unintended pregnancy, 89% are currently using contraception. The two most popular forms of contraception are the pill and sterilization, both of which are covered under the HHS mandate. Considering these numbers, it makes about as much sense to characterize people who support contraception access as stupid and sex-obsessed as it does to characterize people who want running water as stupid and hydration-obsessed. And conservatives know this. The only reason they ran with this issue is that it gave them a chance to call women stupid and pretend that Obama was to blame for it. But female voters didn't buy it, as the gender gap was, as usual, incredibly hefty this election. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, the Misogyny Spins Out of Control edition. Female voters turned out in high numbers for Obama, and Rush Limbaugh responds by saying foul things. I know, you must be shocked.
Unmarried women backed Obama 68% to 30%. They thought Romney's going to take away their birth control pills. Obama treats them like vaginas, and they say, he's my man.
Fact check. They just didn't think that, but Romney promised it. He said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, which would mean an end to the current contraception coverage. He also said he would cut all of Planned Parenthood's funding. Now Limbaugh is mad at women for believing him. But again, I would like to reiterate, because women want reproductive health care doesn't mean we're nothing but vaginas. Limbaugh receives health care for his art, but no one thinks he's only a heart. In fact, many of us metaphorically wonder if he has one at all.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.